It's time. The audience is going nuts out there.
I can't go on.
What do you mean you can't go on? This is Shabu. The joint is packed. Everybody's here to see Big Mama Wolf.
I'm in a weird mood.
What kind of mood?
Well, I woke up this morning and nobody was in my business.
I don't understand.
I said I woke up this morning and nobody was in my business. Now I can't reach no ophthalmologist and I'm stuck here with true alternating strabismus.
That's an eye condition, right?
I woke up this morning, nobody was in my business. I said I woke up this morning, and nobody was in my business. Well, I can't reach no ophthalmologist, and I'm stuck here with true alternating strabismus.
I think you got the blues.
Do I? Are you sure? The whole time I've been touring as Big Mama Wolf, I've never actually had the blues. Please don't tell anybody that.
Well, you've got them now. You got them true alternating strabismus no ophthalmologist blues.
You're right. I'm going out there. Hello, Willimantic! I want to sing a song I wrote about an obscure optical problem in which the two eyes fail to maintain proper alignment. But first, let me introduce today's show, the story of two remarkable music and dance halls, one gone and the other frozen in time. And now he got fired by Aerosmith for using Joe Perry's hairbrush, Colin McEnroe.
Actually, Aerosmith was one of the bands that played the Shabu Inn in Willimantic during its wild 11-year or so run, and it was when Aerosmith was very new. People didn't know much about it. We'll tell you more of that story later on in this show. For the first segment, we're going to do something we don't do very often. I'm going to kind of step out of the studio and let somebody else tell the story. Earlier this summer, Betsy Kaplan, Kyone Wolf, and Katie Tularski went out to this remarkable facility called Thrall Hall in East Windsor. The story was so colorful and so different, we decided to tell it a different way. Katie's the executive producer here at WNPR, but, you know, like Liam Neeson, she has certain skills, and she's a great audio documentary writer and producer. So she took this story over. She's going to tell it. I would recommend, if you're near a computer while it's going, if you can get on WNPR.org right now and look at the photos taken by Kyone Wolf out there, you'll get kind of a sense. It's almost impossible to convey what Thrall Hall is like, even with a really good radio documentary. So for the next few minutes anyway, Katie will be telling the story. I'll be coming back afterwards to tell the story of Shabu Inn with David Foster, the story of rock and roll and jazz and blues in a very obscure corner of Connecticut. But here goes Katie.
You might say that the two great loves of Edwin Thrall's life were his wife Flicka and his daughter Jeanette, his only child who he wanted to protect.
She was a cheerleader and she was into acrobatics, just like throwing these young people to the wolves when they got out of high school with nothing except beer parties out in the woods somewhere.
So he built his third great love, a square dance hall, a place where his wife could dance and his daughter could be safe.
Well, I wanted a place to call square dancing. I wanted a place for Jeanette to have her friends and give them recreation that we thought was civilized and moral and helpful and would last them as long as they lived.
That's Ed Thrall from a 1997 documentary. He was an old-fashioned, patriotic man who came from a family of hard-working potato farmers. His daughter Jeanette says he was very generous and a true Yankee.
Through and through, heart of gold, he would help anybody. He took in every stray cat there was. We had people living in campers or up in the apartment. You know, he always helped people. So he had a heart of gold, but he also had a very strong, stubborn streak.
Thrall died in 2003 at the age of 84, and he was stubborn till the end. Not long before his death, he spent 6 months in prison for getting into a shootout with local police. And it wasn't the first time that happened. He shot a gun into the air and at the tire of a cop car. He would say he didn't intend to hurt anyone, but to protect what he considered his, the 20,000-square-foot dance hall, the building that he spent 10 years meticulously constructing.
He had a very strong sense that his property was his, to do with what he wanted. And when he first got the permit, there was no zoning, but then zoning was put into place, and he didn't like it. And the town and he started to butt heads, and it got very ugly.
When Jeanette remembers her dad today, it's mostly with pride for what he's accomplished. But when she reflects on the ugly days, there's sadness too, remembering how hard he fought for what he built and how that fight changed him.
It got lost over time, what he was really fighting for, because it ended up being the constitutional fight and property rights, and the issue got so much bigger than the building itself that I think it just took on a life of its own, and the building was sort of secondary at that point. Mm-hmm. And he would have, you know, he threatened to burn it down when the town foreclosed. He didn't, thankfully, but, you know, at that point, his principles were more important than the structure.
It's hard to know where to start his story. Ed Thrall in his tri-cornered hat, the hall built from Hartford's historical remnants, or Thrall's only child dealing with her dad's complicated legacy and still trying to make his dream a reality. Today, the property is only slightly different than it was when Thrall was alive, at the end of a long, winding driveway, across from the family's old potato farm, an L-shaped structure covered in black, brown, and purple shingles, a long hall with a four-story tower on one side. It looks unfinished, with scaffolding. There's a long stovepipe and strategically placed windows.
He did it mostly by himself. There were certain people that would come over and help him with the brownstone that you'll see downstairs. And he had a crane help put up the trusses. Primarily, he did it by himself with his tractor.
This is a project and a half. Let's go in.
Jeanette gave us a tour with her husband, Doug, and Howard Epstein, a professor of engineering at UConn. Epstein has been involved with the building for years, facilitating student projects and advising Jeanette and Doug.
I just love what Ed does with everything. See what these things are? Sewing machine bases from the Singer sewing machine plant that was demolished as the I-84 corridor went through. And just all sorts of farm equipment everywhere. Probably if you sold this thing for parts, it'd be worth millions.
You could say Ed Thrall was in the right place at the right time. Old buildings in Hartford and many surrounding towns were being dismantled to make room for highways. He helped demolish many of these buildings and collected what was considered junk.
He said sometimes he, in lieu of being paid, he says, "Can I have that?" He was called the old stone picker.
Then he got into Hartford and started seeing everything being demolished, and he had this farm, so he said, we can't destroy that, we can't throw that to the dump. So he started bringing everything home, and at some point he said, what am I going to do with all this? And that's when he decided to build this, and he just started building.
A counter from Spinella's spaghetti factory, a spiral staircase from the foyer of Landers, Ferry & Clark, floor trusses from the Billings & Spencer building, brownstone, granite, and a railing from the Hubline Hotel.
But it was curved, so Ed ran over it with his tractor to straighten it out as much as he could. But you still see a little bit of a wave in it.
He even recovered a door from a speakeasy at the Guard Hotel, covered in messages written with lipstick.
Ed started with the fireplace. That was the first thing that he built.
Well, this is the top of it.
Yeah. But it's about 40 feet tall, this masonry thing. You're looking at the second floor of it, but that was all that there was, and then the building was built around it.
Thrall's wife designed the tiled floors with different patterns of colors to correspond with more than 200 dancer positions. He worked on the structure between 1968 and 1978.
Shall we go down the spiral staircase and see what's happening underneath?
The enormous basement has a fountain, a meeting room, and a rundown kitchen.
So this is where people would eat, the meeting, and then dancing upstairs. So that's how he envisioned it.
On the opposite end, the stairs lead back up to a stage and a maze of rooms winding up the structure.
It's like one of those dreams that you have. You just open another door and there's more, and it just keeps going on and on and on.
What Ed Thrall hoped would eventually be a general store, an apartment, and the platform of a giant slide for kids.
Well, they would square dance at the Storton Village in the Big E. And, of course, I was always there by myself, and so I would go on the slide. So he was going to bring one here to me, being the spoiled only child, right? But he thought it was a good idea to entertain the kids.
The dance hall itself is 70 feet wide, lined with benches.
The floor is bouncy. It's not quite as much when you get to the middle, but as you'll see what the support was.
The support is a whole lot of truck tires. Tires connected by hoses so that the pressure can be adjusted depending on how much bounce you want.
The bounce is pretty good when you have 50 dancers. During one of the weddings, they were all dancing and we were underneath and it was like, whoa, it really works. So.
Jeanette and her husband got married at the hall 30 years ago, one of a few private weddings and events they've had on the property. They aren't allowed to rent it out now because it isn't up to code. It's a problem that her dad dealt with from the time the hall was being built to his death. At one point, the town put an injunction on the property to keep Ed Thrall from hosting events, which they thought were too dangerous. He, of course, didn't listen and ended up in prison for 50 days.
It started probably getting uglier while I was in college, so around 21, and it went till my dad died. No, probably till 2002.
He held a few events, some where the police actually showed up to dance, but he couldn't shake the bad relations between him and the town. And it wasn't only the police shootouts that led to a rift in his own family. The dark stain on Ed Thrall's legacy came when he invited the KKK to town to have a rally on his property.
I guess it hit its crescendo in 86. We got married and we're living in Atlanta and we decided to move home. I'm not sure I can tell a story.
Yeah. It was right about the time our daughter was born, and we very much disagreed with her father. Her father, we believe, was very much misled, and we tried to explain that to him, that this is not what you think, and this will not be interpreted as you think. And it was a little more strongly stated than that. And short story,
He disowned us.
Jeanette and Doug said that this period in their dad's life is why they shy away from interviews. They said that the KKK misrepresented themselves to Ed, posing as a property rights group. They said that the group took advantage of Ed's anger towards the town and used it for their own publicity. In interviews, Ed Thrall said that the organization was strictly business people and not racist, despite the fact they held a cross burning on his yard. Whatever the case, it cost Ed Thrall a lot of credibility in the community.
And it wasn't till after the baby was born that we reconnected. Every time this story is told, that's obviously the big flash that shows up that says, here's where that happened, and it's been misrepresented.
I decided we were going to re-roof it, whether it was town property or... I knew it was mine, but the town claimed they owned it. We needed a crane to put the materials up there, the pallets of roll roofing and cement, heavy stuff that I am not man enough to carry up several flights of stairs. The crane was putting it up when part of the town maintenance crew saw us up there and called a selectman who called the police who came and demanded we were criminal trespassing on town property. I happened to have a good 12-gauge shotgun, and I went in and got that where it was hidden, and I let it go off, which set off the incident.
The last time was when he was on the roof with the gun and shot at the police cruisers. He didn't shoot at the police, because if he wanted to kill the police, he would have killed them, but he shot at the cruisers to try to get them to leave him alone. And he was trespassing because it wasn't his property at that point, and he had unlawful shooting, all of the above, and he was convicted and went to jail for 6 months, and he was 78 years old at that point.
While he was in prison, Jeanette and Doug made an arrangement with the town, which had foreclosed on the property, to buy it back for $100,000.
The reason we bought it was so that he could come over here, and I think it probably knocked the stuffing out of him. The fight was what kept him going, too. He was mad,
We were never quite sure if he was glad we did that or not.
If he was glad that you bought it.
Yeah. He thought that was giving in. The alternative was the town would have sold it to somebody who would have probably developed it. But to him, it was us giving in by purchasing it.
The way his court case went, he couldn't walk on the property after he got out of jail, or he would be back in for 3 years.
When Ed got out of jail, he was tired and weak, essentially bedbound, until he died 6 years later. During that time, he only took a few more trips across the street to his dance hall.
All my life, I never felt that I had control of my life. You got no resistance, no rights. You're just a slave. Do as you're told, or they throw you in prison, or they take your property.
Jeanette and Doug were left to repair his legacy, to finish the hall and make it into something.
He was trying to explain to me how to finish it, you know. As he was saying, well, you know, you just got to put some big lumber down there and cover it with foam and battleship linoleum. And, you know, he had a whole plan, you know, how the thing was going to come
together. His mind went until the day he died. I mean, he would tell us, yeah, everything that had to be done.
And he'd talk about this, like, you're going to finish this. Yeah, okay, yeah. After I get home from work.
What we'd love to do with it is make an event facility, because it's a great place for a party and people love to come here, and it's big, you can have large groups, and so we'd love to be able to get through the zoning and the CO and have it be a legal structure and have it be where people can come, because it really is a place people should come and enjoy. It should be a destination point, and I think it would be good for the town too.
Jeanette, Doug, and Howard plan to keep working at it until Edwin Thrall's Hall is open to the public.
I mean, there's so many things you could have. You could have plays, you can have weddings, you can have
concerts.
A music venue would be fun.
Class reunions. All that kind of thing. And Ed's idea for this place was to be square dancing.
That was executive producer Katie Tularski with the story of Thrall Hall. To see photos by Kyone Wolf, visit our website, WNPR.org. Thanks to Doug Cohen for use of his archival audio. We'll be back after this with David Foster and the story of Shabu. So it's music hall day here in our lives. That was one kind of music hall story. I have to say, talking about music halls, I mean, for me, being a person of a certain age and growing up in Connecticut, you say music hall, I say Shabu. Shabu, it was in eastern Connecticut. David Foster and I have been I've got a really comprehensive list of everybody who played at Shabu. And there were certain acts that kind of were known as Shabu acts, maybe James Montgomery Band, James Cotton Band, NRBQ, Jonathan Edwards, Bonnie Raitt, Roomful of Blues, Orleans. But then, B.B. King, Muddy Waters, Freddie King, Buddy Guy, Junior Wells, every blues act you can think of played there, every rock act, Joe Cocker, Eric Burdon, Dr. John, David Crosby, Todd Rundgren. As things went along, as we headed sort of more towards the 80s, AC/DC, The Police, Elvis Costello, Journey, Hall & Oates, The Talking Heads, Iggy Pop, Television, The Cars, The Ramones. Everybody from basically Count Basie to The Ramones played Shabu at some point or other. So David Foster, the guy who made that all happen, starting at the tender age of 19, is here in studio with us. Explain what this was for people who have no idea, who've never heard of Shabu. First of all, the building was well over 100 years old by the time you got your hands on it, right? It was an old sort of thread mill from the Thread City days.
It was 1800s, and it was a thread mill. It was 6,400 square feet per floor. Mm. One of the nice things about it was all wood, so it had a really nice sound to it.
Now, the other thing it was it wasn't. It was really kind of in the middle of nowhere. I mean, not that Willimantic is the middle of nowhere, and not that it was really exactly in Willimantic anyway, right? It was technically in Mansfield.
It was in Mansfield.
Yeah. But, I mean, it wasn't near a big city. So how did you get everybody to come there? How did all of these acts wind up in this place?
Well, I mean, I think we were pretty lucky. As we were planning to open it in the summer and doing all our work, and we went up to Boston University to see James Montgomery for the first time. Mm. And lo and behold, who was the opening act? It happened to be Aerosmith. Mm-hmm. So we got to meet both James and Aerosmith that night. Mm-hmm. And I negotiated a booking with Stevie Tyler at the side of the stage in between a fight that he got into with a patron. And, you know, we told him we were going to open this club in Connecticut, and we had hotel rooms up above, and that we could also put them up, and would they be interested in coming to play for a few nights? Mm-hmm. He goes, well, yeah, we'd love to play there. And I said, well, you know, we've got like $700 for the week for you if you'd like to like to play. And he said, how about $1,000? I said, no, we can't really do that because we only charge $1 to get in, and we buy everybody their first drink. Mm-hmm. But we'll put you up, and we'll also give you a bottle of gin every night, the band. So the deal was cut, and they ended up playing the second week we were open.
Wow. And at that time, Aerosmith wasn't necessarily a name to conjure with, right? I mean,
no, they were unsigned, and they were basically doing Rolling Stone covers and showed up in a school bus. Mm-hmm. That was how their mode of transportation was.
I'm guessing having Aerosmith stay overnight, even then, in any facility that you're nominally in charge of, is something of a risk. I mean, like, what did the upstairs look like after they'd stayed there?
It was sort of like hoodoo the hoodoo man. I mean, we don't know if we were more scared or they were more scared when they saw the upstairs of the Shabu. So it was a toss up in the end. But yeah. You know, but they went for it. They were very happy and they liked it, and we had a good time with them. Our bartenders were all female at the time, so it was their first. How would you say their first meeting with spandex pants. And the whole band was in colored spandex, so they were going, boy, they're kind of strange with the spandex, you know, but and the shag haircuts. But.
Okay, we've got a lot of artists to talk about, a lot of stories to tell here, but just to sort of give you a sense of how Shabu sounded. Fortunately, a lot of recordings were kind of made right off the soundboard. So one of the bands that I mentioned that was really kind of a Shabu band was the Fabulous Rhinestones. And once again, if you were sort of from the Northeast at that time, you knew about the Fabulous Rhinestones, an amazing, amazing band. And so let's just hear them getting into their act one night at Shabu.
This night is for you, Shabu. I guess the Rhinestones have played here at the Shabu about 100 or 200 times, I don't know, over the last 8 years. It's a wonderful thing for us that we can just keep doing it. People keep showing up, taking pictures of us. It's great. It's really great. It's good to see each and every one of you. We're going to send this out to all y'all. That's right.
All right, that's the Rhinestones. And so as you were doing this, David, first of all, you were 19, right?
I was 19 when we first opened.
And how did this facility come into the possession of your family? How did you happen to have this place and decide it was going to be a music hall?
Well, we were very chummy with the John family from the Storrs area, and their parents had a famous eatery, late night Yukon spot called Lou's, and they had funny named sandwiches like the Stop Sandwich and the, you know, all these crazy sandwiches, and all the Yukon students would frequent the place late at night after studying or after a game, and we just became very close friends with them, and we all loved music, and we wanted to have our own nightclub, so what we did is we picked that particular place because the man that owned it was an old French-Canadian man, and he was really kind of a real character. Mm-hmm. More so of a character, I would say, than our first segment of the show.
Okay.
And his name was Willie Gamache. He was an old French-Canadian man. And, you know, he figured that the only person he could ever sell it to was kids because, you know, the building was a little bit challenged. But there were things that he did to it. Like, he would put a wall up in the middle of a window. Stuff like that. So, you know. It would be funny, the Laurel and Hardy thing where one guy's opening the window and the other guy on the other side's closing it. But anyway, so we borrowed the money from the vendors, the people that had the cigarette machines and the pinball things. Mm. Those were the banks in those days for bars because banks would never lend money to bars. It was too risky. So we actually talked them into lending us $35,000 to buy the place. We had 5,000 left of the 35 for decorating the club. Mm-hmm. So what we did is we bought a whole bunch of black paint and painted the ceiling black, a whole bunch of red paint to paint the walls red. And we went to the Brand Rex wire cable company in Willimantic and begged and borrowed for 100 spools. And those became our tables, the spools. Then we went up to the attic and took the floorboards out of the attic to put them on the tops of the spindles and then stained everything. And then we just bought red light bulbs for the ceiling. Instant atmosphere. It looked great. We opened October 22nd, 1971. And, you know, we just did this air campaign with a private plane over the football games at UConn saying, Shabu is coming. Shabu is coming. But we didn't say anything more than that. Anyway, the final week before we opened, we let them know it was a nightclub. We opened to two nights of sellouts, and then the second week, Aerosmith was there. The third week, James Montgomery was there. And then the blues, a man named Dick Waterman, who managed Bonnie Raitt, called us and hooked us up with all the blues greats. And we used the blues musicians to develop the audience there. Because in the first few weeks, it was just 500 kids in a room. Not even knowing how to be really an audience. They were just, it was like a meat market.
And a lot of those blues musicians, I would assume also, they were just really committed to playing a lot, playing every night, you know, playing as much as they can.
Well, they were booked by the week.
Yeah.
You'd book them by the week, and we had the luxury of the rooms upstairs so we could put them up. But what was key is they put on this show where they made the audience be an audience, you know, so you couldn't help but become an audience.
Yeah.
And what we do is we booked the first 4 or 5 months of just by the week blues legends, the John Lee Hookers, the Howlin' Wolves, the Buddy Guy and Junior Wells, Freddie King, Muddy Waters, James Cotton, Bluesman. And these guys were just phenomenal. I mean, it was a real show. And lo and behold, an audience has been developed.
I'm going to cross Wolfie up a little bit here since you mentioned Muddy Waters. We've got a clip, and this is kind of an interesting thing. I don't know at what point, David, this kind of thing started to happen, but I think in this clip you're going to hear Muddy singing, but he's also trying to get you to sing, and you're on the soundboard. Let's see if we can hear that.
I was trapped, yeah.
Yeah.
We're going to have David. One of the owners going to come and sing a song for us. Why, to get him together, I started doing another blues for you to have David get you out.
Hey, Muddy, I'm on the board here. I there's no way I can get to the stage. I'm on the board, so I'll just sing it from the board, all right?
All right, come on down.
Every day I have the blues.
I'm sure David wants us to play that whole thing, but then we won't have any time to talk. So how did that happen? I mean, there's a lot of people who own music halls, but they don't sing with Muddy Waters. How'd that happen?
Somebody had hipped him, you know, and said that, you know, the club owner can sing. And, you know, I was so lucky because, you know, they told everybody, all the blues guys, so I got to sing with Willie Dixon, I got to sing with Muddy Waters, I got to sing with Howlin' Wolf and T-Bone and, you know, Cotton and BB and... So, I mean, I got like a really major education in blues singing.
You went to Blues University.
Right. So, I mean, I was the luckiest guy in the whole world. And, you know, to this day, I'm still, you know, I shiver just thinking about it.
We should say, I mean, David went on to start the Shabu All-Stars, which are now the Mohegan Sun Shabu All-Stars. He's also got a new release coming out called The Real Thing as D.A. Foster, because it's very confusing. You're David Foster, and then there's this other David Foster guy.
Right. The famous guy made it obvious because this one's going to get released, you know, through the whole country and all of Europe. So I have a real record deal finally.
We got to talk about some of these acts. And some of these acts would come in, and you know, you don't really know what to expect. They don't know what to expect. I think one of the great stories is of Tom Waits doing two different dates not too far apart at Shabu. Before I have you tell those stories of those two performances, I think we've got the Tom Waits song anyway that sets up these anecdotes.
The piano has been drinking. My nectar is asleep. And the combo went back to New York. The jukebox says to take a leak. And the carpet needs a haircut.
All right, so that's Tom. You booked Tom the first time, and basically what happens?
We were early. We were too early on him.
Yeah.
Record came out, a little bit late for when our date matured. So what happened was there was about 25 people there the first night. Mm-hmm. And what happened is about halfway through the show, we had Shabu animals. We had cats. We had dogs. And the Shabu cat just decided to prance up to the stage and jump on the piano while Tom was deep in song, and Tom just was, wow, he was just enamored. So anyway, at the end of the night, he came upstairs to do settlement, and I was thanking him and sort of apologizing, saying, you know, sorry there wasn't a lot of people here, I think we're a little early. And he goes, nah, man, this place is heavy, man. I who's the cat, you know? So, you know, I just said, well, would you ever consider coming back, like, at the end of the tour? Because I think we could really, you know, do a much better job. He goes, yeah, man, this place is great, man. I can't wait to come back. I'll tell everybody to book me back here. Anyway, we called the agency the next morning, told them what had happened. They gave us a night at the tail end of the run. Mm-hmm. He came back, sold 1,000 seats, sold it out cold. And at the end of that night, of course, we're back in the office again doing settlement. I go, a little bit better this time, huh, Tom? You must have really enjoyed it tonight. He goes, nah. He goes, I dug it the first time. Yeah. I mean, these are the kind of characters that I would deal with on a normal basis, you know. So,
yeah.
And he was swell.
He liked the 25 guy. People and the cat.
Yeah, he loved it.
Yeah.
He just loved it. And chain smoked through the holes.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And so when settling up, how did that work? How did, in other words, what did a performer take away from Shabu? What was your typical arrangement?
Usually there were guarantees versus percentages, in most situations, because they were all represented by real major theatrical booking companies in either New York or Los Angeles. So, you know, I mean, sometimes we took it on the chin. We might be a little early, but I think in Tom Waits' case, I think we got a pretty good buy because we were early on him. We always put a percentage clause in. So if business came, the artist was rewarded.
Mm-hmm.
Always. So.
This whole idea of being early is interesting, too, because you were early with some of these groups. I mean, the Police came and played there on the very first tour when, A, nobody knew who the Police were.
It was their second date in America.
Second date in America?
Yeah.
And the World Series, right?
And it happened to be the World Series the same night. And it was a Monday night.
Yeah.
So we had everything working against us. But what had happened was the drummer's brother was the agent for the Police.
Mm-hmm.
So Ian Copeland, a famous booking agent, he called me and said, look, I want you to play this band next Monday called the Police. We were supposed to play Brown University. Something happened. I got to put them somewhere. I go, oh, Ian, come on. I mean, it's the World Series Monday night. I haven't had a day off in 12 days. We've had major shows here. And he went, Lefty, do you want to do Iggy Pop? I went, yeah. He goes, well, you're going to work Monday night. He goes, I don't care. Just look, charge $1 to get in, give him the door. I just got to put him somewhere. Mm-hmm. Do me the favor. I went, and that's what our role was, do agents favors. Our job was to break artists and prepare them for Jimmy Coblick. That's what our job was.
Is it true that you told Sting not to start playing until the World Series was over, the game?
Well,
was over?
What we said is, look, you know, Sting was pacing in the bar room, and there was the seventh inning tie game World Series. And, you know, there was 12 of us that were watching the World Series. It was a Monday night. So, you know, this guy's pacing, and we're going, hey, what's your name? He goes, Sting. I went, Sting, look, we're going to go watch your band play tonight. You want a hamburger or something? You know, well, you want some food? But as soon as the game's over, you can play your set. We'll all go in and watch you play your set. He was not happy. He was not happy at all. So, anyway, the World Series comes to an end. We go in the back room. And all of a sudden, he starts singing. you know, Roxanne. We go, hey, this guy sounds good, man. You know, we listen to the whole set. As soon as he left, like 2 days later, I turn on WHCN, Roxanne hits the airwaves.
Mm-hmm.
Goes into heavy rotation everywhere.
Yeah.
So we were just early. And then the second play is when you saw him, when they graduated to the 2,000, 3,000
yeah.
capacity room and they went to the West Hartford Music Hall.
Dexter Avenue, whatever that place right. was, yeah.
Yeah.
So a lot of artists are really nice people. And for example, you guys had a great relationship with Bonnie Raitt, right? To this day, she's playing someplace else.
She was absolutely wonderful to us, and she understood our plight. She knew we were challenged as far as, you know, survival. We were top heavy. There's five partners, and we were wholesaling all the music to the young people. So there wasn't a lot of profit there. So she was just very bright, and she wanted to do anything she could to keep us going. So every time we got in trouble, we'd call Waterman in Boston and go, Dick, we need help. You know, the oil tank's almost empty. You know, it's freezing. You know, so anyway, he'd look at the calendar. He goes, how's, you know, next Thursday? Yeah, we can do some radio. We'll fill it up. Mm-hmm. And he'd send us a contract for a straight 80%. And she never charged us a guarantee.
Mm-hmm.
She must have played 50 nights, and every night was a sellout.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I remember one night we did Bonnie Raitt and Little Feet, and it was a $2 ticket.
That's outrageous. Yeah. Little George still there?
No.
No, after Little George. All right. Well, still pretty good. All right. Let's take a break. Bonnie Raitt, by the way, we should say she's still, if she's playing Oakdale or whatever they call it these days, you know, we'll ask if anybody out there remember Shabu or dedicate a song to you or something. I mean, that's still big in her heart, I think, you know, the Shabu days.
To this day, she still remembers us, and we love her for it.
All right, so she was a sweetheart. When we come back, we might talk about one or two slightly more difficult artists to deal with. But as we're going out here, there have been songs sung about Shabu. This one doesn't mention Shabu, but you listen to it, you know, absolutely know it's by Elvin Bishop. It's called Juke Joint Jump, and it's about Shabu.
I'm stuck here on this isthmus with true alternating strabismus. I ain't seen my optician since a week before Christmas. Now I got the blues about how bad my blues song is. Today's show was produced by Betsy Kaplan and me. Our interns are Josh Nalea and Nia Tyler. Greg Hill appeared in the intro and tweets for us at WNPR Colin. Katie Tolarski is our executive producer. The part of Bill Curry was played by Muddy Waters. For show pages, audio, and pictures of the Faith Middleton Show staff snorting Zantac at the Todd Rundgren after party, visit our website, WNPR.org. And now, back to Colin.
Right now, the party's here. David Foster is here telling stories of Shabu. So Bonnie Raitt, a sweetheart, always took care of you guys any way she could. Some people are a little bit more difficult. So you did book Miles Davis.
Oh, man. Oh, God.
So tell that story.
Booked him for a week.
Yeah.
Actually, it was done through the Jazz Workshop in Boston. The famous talent buyer and promoter, Freddie Taylor, helped us achieve that major goal in our jazz history. He played for a week. It was a Wednesday through Saturday. Opening night shows up Wednesday night. And all of a sudden, I get a call at 6 o'clock. Miles is over at the Willimantic Motor Inn, about just, you know, 400 yards from the club. Miles is not going to play tonight. His hairdresser didn't show up. That was the cancellation. So I was just, you know, I look outside. There's a line of 350 people out to the street. We hadn't even opened the doors yet. We're there. So I run to my office and I call Freddie Taylor in Boston. I go, Freddie, what is going on? I mean, we were just called by Miles from the hotel, and he's canceling opening night because his hairdresser can't work on his hair. I said, what am I to do? I got 300 people standing outside ready to come in. They've come in from all over the state. He goes, Lefty, just go tell them the truth. Go out there and tell them the truth. They're used to the antics of Miles. and let them know that you'll honor their tickets for any one of the last 3 days. I said, well, I can't. The last 2 days are sold out. Well, that you'll honor the tickets tomorrow night. You got room tomorrow night to honor these? I go, yeah, where's room for tomorrow night? He goes, just go tell them the truth. I go, they're going to stone me. He goes, I promise they won't. They're used to it with Miles. So anyway, I meekishly go out the front door and I make the announcement. And he had said to me, tell the truth. Just tell them because they're used to it. Anyway, I told them the exact truth. Nobody stoned me. Nobody threw anything at me. Nobody booed. They just turned around, went back to their cars, got in their cars, and drove away. I told them their tickets would be honored tomorrow night. Anyway, the second night rolls around and full house, yeah. Just sold out. I mean, he never faced the crowd. He played with his back to the crowd the entire 3 days that were left. And he called for advances for money every 3 hours from the hotel. Now, the second night, when he finally appeared, he didn't have a car. He didn't have anything. Mm-hmm. So he needed a ride back to the hotel. At the time, I had a Chevy Impala with a bench seat, you know, so I figured I'd be a gentleman as the promoter and open the door for Mr. Davis to get in. He walked right by the front door and gets into the back seat. So it was sort of like, you know, white boy, you're going to take me, you're going to chauffeur me over to the hotel. Anyway, it happened to be my birthday. Mm-hmm. So I bring him over to the motor, and it takes about 3 minutes to ride. And he's mumbling in the back seat and does not get out of the car when we get there. So I figured it out after about 15 seconds. He's waiting for me to go open the door.
Right.
So finally, I don't want to spend the night here. This is the longest 20 seconds of my life. I get out of the car, and then I go open the door, and I'm pretty frustrated at that point. And he puts his hand out to shake my hands. And a bell went off in my head, Colin, and I just went, that'll be $20. You know, if you want to treat me like that, you're going to pay me. So he went right into his pocket, gave me a $20 bill, and I felt much better. Then I went back to my birthday party, had cake. But, I mean, that's the kind of negative stuff. I mean, sometimes they were tough, you know.
I love the playing with his back to the audience. You know, Laura Nero, who played Shabu, she would occasionally do that too. She would, but I think for a different reason. I think she was too anxious to look at the audience or something like
that. She was so shy. Yeah, she was just
maybe somebody who an amazing songwriter performing, maybe kind of a challenge.
Right. There were more singer-songwriters than entertainers.
We got a lot of calls here. Let's talk to Tom in Colchester. Find out what happened to him at Shabu. Hi, Tom. You're on the air.
I went there, you know, to see Rick Derringer, a rock and roll, hoochie-coop type of guy. Anyway, I walked in with my 16-year-old teeny bopper girlfriend, drinking, which is 18 back then. And there was, like, one table left, and it was in front of this, like, refrigerator-sized speaker, which was big for the time. So I sat down, and we enjoyed ourselves. And afterwards, he came over and sat down next to us and said, anybody crazy enough to sit in front of this speaker? Got to be a friend of mine.
So how's your hearing today, Tom?
When I heard you show up the Shabu, my ears started ringing again.
All right. Just a Pavlovian response. All right. Let's grab another call here from – it's funny because I was going down this list with David and I was saying, you know, there's some names here that I haven't thought about in 20, 25 years. And one of them was an act that – or a performer who – I mean, really, I've not thought about this guy in 25 years. But Karen has been thinking about him apparently. So, Karen, tell us your Shabu story.
Well, I remember standing in the rain for like an hour in line for somebody that nobody else ever seemed to hear about. I'm surprised it was a line. And it happened to be Jimmy Ferris. And I don't think that very many people even know the man existed.
Yeah, no, I'm amazed. I said that when you came in, David. I said, Jimmy Ferris, when was the last time anybody thought of him? But you thought he was really talented.
We very much need to thank the folks at WHCN. They had a very, very open playbook in those days, and they broke Jimmy Ferris. So Arthur was there.
Let's grab one more call here. Here's Chris in Warren. Hi, Chris. You're on the air.
Yeah, I just thought you actually, after this last break, touched on what I wanted to touch on, which is not all these guys, the popular guys that everybody knows, big rock guys, but there was world music. There was jazz. John McLaughlin played there.
Right.
We see John McLaughlin. Weather Report played, you know, the 830 record, the heavy weather record. It was just, we saw world music in front of our face, 10 feet away from us.
Right.
Well, those are good memories for you, Chris. That's glad to.
We were guilty that night because it was a $4 ticket. We felt terrible. We felt like capitalist pigs because it was $4 to get in.
I know. I was actually looking at old posters and looking at those $3 tickets and $2 tickets, and I was thinking, okay, that's that's something we'll never see again. And, you know, that must be for you just to listen to music now. Just so many. We were driving back from Montreal a couple of days ago, and so we bought the new Leonard Cohen CD as close to Leonard's old haunts as we possibly could. He's 80. He's got a new CD out. I mean, every time you turn on the radio, you must be sort of flooded with memories. Just as a sense, now you're a performer. Is it good to not have all those responsibilities? Do you miss running a club like Shabu? Do you miss all of that? Or is it so much easier to be the guy who kind of walks in and...
Well, I totally miss it. But my saying now is if somebody offered me the keys to a brand new nightclub in 2014 and they said, it's yours, David, it's all paid for, it's yours, I wouldn't take it.
Yeah.
Because it's almost impossible to make it work now because the climate is so different. The money is so different. The media is different. The record companies are basically, gone. Mm-hmm. So, the whole industry is so fractured and so messed up in comparison to when we were coming up. Radio was strong. Record companies were strong. The songwriting was incredible. That decade of the 70s was, there's so much there. And the record companies kept us going. They'd support the touring artists. All those things came into play. Plus, we could wholesale music. A young person could support a nightclub like that 3 or 4 nights a week. Mm. And today, it's so expensive to do everything. Just to drive your car somewhere and then park it, never mind get into the club. Mm-hmm. And moving artists around the country with planes and this and that. It's just a whole different climate. So it's very, very challenging. It's not as challenging. The place to be if you're going to be in the promotion business is, with big, big, large capacity places doing the big touring acts. Otherwise, it's very, very challenging. So anybody that is in the club business today, I have the utmost respect for. And I try in every way through my production company to keep them going.
David Foster, it's been so great to talk to you. David Foster is the owner of Shabu Productions, the leader of the Mohegan Sun All-Stars, and his new recording, The Real Thing, under the name D.A. Foster, will be released in January. We'll see if he can still sing the way he sang with Muddy Waters back in the day.
So let the neighbors talk about us. We're going to have the time of our lives. And it feels all right. I got a bad case. Ooh. Worse than the last one.
Worse than the last one. Oh, yeah.
Got the sweat and burn. A fever keep me up all night. I want to celebrate.
Ooh.
My new affair.
I woke up this morning, clearly, because, I'm here, I'm not still sleeping. Thank you, Shabu!